Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor.
Your Honor, this is a case about the wood bison that was listed as endangered under the Endangered Species Act and the provisions to recover attorney's fees under the Endangered Species Act. The Act doesn't provide benefits for foreign species as it does for domestic species. That's not widely known, but the Secretary Ventura and the Fish and Wildlife Service knows that well. They recognize that its listing under the Endangered Species Act was actually harming its recovery. The Canadian Wildlife Service expressed that to the service. The Wood Bison Recovery Team expressed that. The Yukon Management Authority expressed that. The Fish and Wildlife Service published that its listing was harming it, and that it was going to grant permits, and that it would benefit it if it granted import permits or hunting trophies. Those trophies would generate revenue for the native people that had to tolerate these wood bison that were displacing their moose and other things. Yet the service didn't act on those permits for 9 long years. Despite every possible effort that could be made, they could not be moved. They were served with a notice of intent to sue, which they disregarded. They were sued, and they still didn't act. After the motion for summary judgment was filed in the case, I believe it was 11 months later, they finally processed those permits that were pending 9 years, 5 to 9 years.
Isn't the fundamental problem here that under the APA, you probably had a successful agency action unreasonably withheld kind of claim, but the standard for getting attorney's fees under the APA, you had a Buckhannon problem, right? And so you're forced, I think, a little bit of a square peg into a round hole here to go under the ESA, which is not as comfortable a home for the substance of your delay claim, but has a better attorney's fees provision. How are we supposed to address this?
That is correct. We have to have a judgment. In 11 months, we were not able to get a judgment. So, and this has happens over and over again. It's not a coincidence or an accident. We never get a judgment under the APA. So we ever have to provide these services for free over and over again. We have other cases pending with the same problem.
Which might be a weakness in the Buckhannon rule, but it is.
So what we've done is this is a regulation of the service, the acting agency in this case, which wasn't true in the Bennett case, incidentally. This is not the Bureau of Reclamation. This is the acting agency in this case. It's its own regulations adopted under 1533 of the ESA to implement the granting of permits or the denial of permits, but the processing. And a quote from Bennett.
There's no time limit in there, right?
I'm sorry?
There's no time limit in those.
There's no express time limit, but it says that as soon as possible, which isn't 9 years, by any imagination.
It can be fast sometimes.
In this case, we didn't have the benefit of the administrative record. But since then, we know that there was no action on the permits for long periods of time. The wood bison have been downlisted as endangered, and the denials have been overturned. That's all subsequent to this case, Wood Bison 1. And Wood Bison 1, we simply couldn't get them to process the permits. And Bennett says that the required procedures of decisional making are mandatory. There's something different, the required procedures for decision making, than the decision itself. So we're not arguing that they should have granted the permits, all right, or that they should have denied them, which they did in this case. They should have processed them. They have their own rules and regulations adopted under a provision of the ESA, 1533.
I'm sorry to interrupt. Doesn't one of the regs also say, though, not to expect a decision with any
90 days
in any particular set time, something to that effect?
It says that the permits, it advises someone to at least give 90 days lap of time if you want something within a certain soon. That's kind of an advisory warning that it might take more than 60 days, but it doesn't say 9 years, Your Honor. And by any stretch of the imagination, these permits were not being processed. And it's a stretch to say that that the service warned that it might take 90 days. 9 years is not 90 days. There can't be an honest pretense here that these permits were being processed. And even after suit, it took 11 months. That's 12, 13 months after a notice of intent to sue. These, we're saying that this is an action agency that Bennett, and we cited two cases, Ninth Circuit Court cases, say when it's the action agency, Bennett doesn't apply, that 1540G1A, which the court didn't, trial court didn't seem to apply in its memorandum opinion, actually says that the regulations of agencies, when it's the action agency, are enforceable under the citizen supervision. And that's what our case hinges on, Your Honor. The argument that this is ESA provisions being implemented under 1533 of the ESA, that the services, the action agency's own regulations, not discretionary at all, but mandatory, that how they will treat the permits, and
well,
that they violated three of them.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't see anything in the regulations that says something to the effect of a permit shall be processed within a year.
No, that's it doesn't say within a specific period of time. That is correct.
That's the hole that's concerning me.
That's it was a problem with the trial judge as well, Your Honor, and it's a crux of the issue. Mm-hmm. But I say that, Your Honor, the crux of the issue is the merits of the case. The real issues here are not turning on nuances like that, but on whether or not the Endangered Species Act is going to be given full force and effect. In this case, it was terribly abused. And we're not talking about misadministration. We're talking about violating their own procedures and guidelines that are they set as mandates for themselves, not for a certain time, but for a reasonable time. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Tamara Rountree, and I represent the United States. And with me at council table is Mr. Hubert Yang, who represented the United States in the district court. The sole question before the court now is one of fees and whether Judge Bates was correct in denying the fees request by Conservation Force. To resolve the underlying citizen suit provision issues that needed to be addressed prior to reaching the fees decision, we need not look any farther than the Supreme Court's decision in Bennett versus Speer. And there, the Supreme Court made clear what may and may not be challenged under Section 1540G1A of the ESA citizen suit provision, made clear what can be brought under Section G1C, and that's the only provision that speaks to non-discretionary duties. And the Bennett Court even went so far as to discuss the adverse implications to the Administrative Procedure Act should Section G1A of the ESA citizen supervision be applied too broadly. Now, Judge Bates, in addressing the underlying citizen suit provision issues, first addressed the question of G1C. And the reason Judge Bates most likely addressed that issue first is because based on the pleading submitted by Conservation Force in the district court, it appeared that that was the sole section of the citizen supervision that they were relying on for purposes of their permit processing claims. And just to clarify for the court, the permit processing claims are the only claims that are at issue for purposes of the fees decision. Judge Bates determined that under Section G1C, the permit processing claims were not reviewable. And that's because G1C speaks to not only, for example, those claims that arise only under Section 1533, which does not cover permit issuances, but it only speaks to non-discretionary duties. And Judge Kavanaugh, you've made clear there's nothing that indicates that there was a non-discretionary duty for the Secretary to issue permits by any date certain. There was discretion, and there is actually language that says that applicants should not assume that the permits will be issued by the dates that they deemed appropriate.
Who are the they in that sense?
I'm sorry, the applicants. If the applicants, for example.
Does that mean that the permits are issued on a schedule that the Secretary actually deems appropriate?
There is no specificity.
I know there's no specific schedule, but just in terms of what the government's aspirations are in this matter. The government doesn't even aspire to remotely prompt disposition of these applications.
Well, I don't work for the service and I can't speak to that, but I wouldn't necessarily say that is the case. To give you a little bit of background, the theory presented by Conservation Force for purposes of receiving these permits was one that the service had not faced before, and even Judge Bates in the decision that he rendered and Conservation Force refers to as a related case in their reply brief. At the beginning of their reply brief, they refer to a case. In Judge Bates' decision in that case, he comes right out and says he recognizes that the issue presented to the service was a thorny one for purposes of issuing the permits there. And again, to give you a little bit more background, under the ESA, permits are issued as exceptions, and that is actually how the section in the statute is entitled. They're exceptions in that they, if granted, authorize activities that would otherwise be prohibited under the statute. So unlike other scenarios where perhaps an agency is issuing permits so they can determine how many people are out in on the forest, or they can determine something a little more innocuous, this is a much different scenario. And the Fish and Wildlife Service can't simply rubber stamp a permit application.
How many years did it actually take?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I just blanked on the amount of time, but I appreciate the point you're trying to...
Opposing counsel spoke of 9 years, I thought. And even for a thorny issue, that seems like a lot.
I appreciate your concerns, and I don't know that this is necessarily under the fees decision. This is the time to determine...
No, one does have curiosity.
The bureaucratic
world passes before us, and we...
I most certainly can.
What's going on?
I can understand your concerns here, but for purposes of the fees issue, Judge Bates looked to G1C again and determined that the permit processing issues could not be rendered those claims could not be reviewable under G1C. And indeed, Conservation Force in its briefing doesn't dispute that finding. Judge Bates next held that citizens may not sue for the Secretary's maladministration of the ESA. That finding by Judge Bates is a direct, in part, directly quotes from the Bennett decision. It not only just quotes from the Bennett decision, but it quotes from the concluding sentence in Bennett that summarizes the Bennett Court's analysis and discussion of Section G1A. Thus indicating that Judge Bates, in rendering that finding about what citizen suits may be brought, adopted not only the Bennett Court's conclusory or some summary conclusion of G1A, but Judge Bates also adopted the Bennett Court's analyses, findings, and rationale that supported that conclusion. So if we look at Judge Bates' decision in its entirety, he found that the permit processing claims could arise under neither G1A nor G1C of the ESA citizen suit provision. And indeed, Judge Bates concluded by saying the ESA citizen suit provision did not authorize judicial review of the permit processing claims. Now, on appeal, the main argument that Conservation Force advances is that they allegedly could have brought their permit processing claims under G1A. And the reason it's more or less hypothetical is because the permit processing claims were dismissed as moot, just again for background purposes, dismissed as moot by Judge Bates. The reason Conservation Force's argument fails is it's a two-pronged reason, and it's really quite simple. First, Conservation Force does not dispute that lawsuits cannot be brought under G1A to challenge the service's duties as administrator of the ESA. They don't dispute that challenges can't be brought under G1A to challenge actions that the agency takes to implement or administer the statute.
Suppose the statute had a time limit in it that said these permit decisions shall be made within 3 years. Could you bring a suit to challenge that, or is the principle you're articulating override some separate statutory?
Arguably, that would represent a non-discretionary duty to act within the 3 years, and we would then look to G1C.
Even though it's still maladministration. I think you have to be careful about overreading Bennett's use of the phrase maladministration.
G1C is the section of the citizen suit provision that addresses non-discretionary duties, which is where we'd get into the issue of timeline. But G1C is specific to actions that arise under Section 1533. So simply because there's a three-year in your hypothetical, a three-year timeline, we still need to see, well, have we satisfied the 1533 aspect? The question of maladministration goes to G1A, where Bennett made clear that when an agency acts, or when the service, for example, acts as the administrator of the statute, to administer the statute, to implement the statute, it cannot be brought, and a challenge cannot be brought under G1A.
Let me ask you, as I understand part of petitioner's arguments, or plaintiff's arguments, that the violation here comes under 1533 because in delaying action on the permits, the species that the secretary was obligated to protect so long as it was listed was being harmed. So that is a violation of a duty that falls under 1533. And they mentioned that in their motion for summary judgment. So the Ninth Circuit cases that they point to have drawn or could be read to draw this distinction as to when there is a substantive violation of the statute, i.e. when the species that is protected is being harmed.
Based on a careful read, again, we begin with Bennett. Bennett is clearly the Bible in this case. If we begin with Bennett, the distinction that's made is between a regulated agency, when an agency acts as an entity that's being regulated, versus when it acts as, if you will, the regulator. If you look at the Ninth Circuit cases on which Conservation Force relied, they make the distinction between when the agency was acting as a regulated entity, and in those cases, under Section 1536A2, all federal agencies must consult with the Fish and Wildlife Service when they conduct, when they authorize, fund, or carry out an action that is likely to jeopardize a species. That is a provision that regulates agencies. It also applies to the Fish and Wildlife Service when it's acting as a regulated agency. But in this case, the Fish and Wildlife Service was carrying out the permit system that it implemented, that it authorized, that it renders decisions under for purposes of implementing the Endangered Species Act. So for purposes of permits, receiving applications, reviewing applications, rendering decisions on applications with respect to these permits, and determining whether these permits will be consistent with the purposes and goals of the ESA, the Fish and Wildlife Service is acting solely as an administrator. Now, as to the question of substantive provisions, there is no dichotomy between a substantive provision and something else, as Conservation Force argues. And if you read Bennett, Bennett says that if an agency is acting as the administrator of a substantive provision, its actions can't be challenged under G1A. And it says, for example, if a regulated agency if one is seeking to enforce substantive provisions against a regulated agency, that, for example, can be brought under G1A. So the question of whether something substantive isn't the dispositive question. Substantive applies to both the administrator, which the administrator versus the regulated. But again, I think the easiest way to look at this is to determine, is the Fish and Wildlife Service acting as the regulator here? And if it is, its actions cannot be challenged under G1A. Those, as you suggest, would be APA actions.
I mean, the hypothetical would be that suppose they filed an application for a permit in year one, and in year 20, they file suit because there's been no action on the application. Meanwhile, the listed species is extinct because no one's been killing them to weed them out so that, you know, they can propagate. That's sort of the scenario the plaintiffs paint.
I understand, and actually in their briefs they use the word violation to apply to pretty much anything that the Fish and Wildlife Service does, and that's not how this question before this the underlying question before this court plays out. The fact that a species might be impacted doesn't constitute a violation, or the fact that something the agency does might ultimately result in a consequence to the species isn't necessarily a violation.
Well, the question argument, though, is that the Secretary does, under 1533, have an express obligation to protect, preserve, et cetera, and to take actions to protect these species that the Secretary has listed.
If I remember my reading of 1533, I don't know that it's that broad. What 1533 requires the Secretary to do, for example, is to determine whether a species is endangered or threatened and to designate critical habitat. It's not a broadcast everything you do.
No, it's not, but there's some very specific duties in 1533.
Understood.
And indeed.
There
is very broad language about protecting, against harm to endangered species that the Secretary has listed. These species were listed.
Understood.
And do you agree with counsel's representation that the agency had acknowledged that listing was harming the bison? That's how I understood counsel to begin his argument.
I'm not remembering what they said.
In other words, as I heard his argument, it was that the agency had acknowledged that continued listing was harming the wood bison, and therefore the Fish and Wildlife announced that it was going to grant these permits. Did you hear him say that?
No, I didn't. And I don't recall that being in his briefing. But the question still is to look at, in order to determine what constitutes a proper action or what is reviewable under the citizen suit provisions, we in essence have to categorize the action. For G1A, again, it goes only to the If the challenge goes to the administration of the statute, and it also, if it goes to the failure of, for example, the Secretary to perform its duties under the ESA, and that's directly from Bennett, you cannot challenge under G1A the Secretary's failure to perform its duties under the ESA in administering the statute.
So why should the district court not have addressed C?
The court did.
It addressed C, but not in this context.
No, it did. It absolutely did. It went through C, and that's where it's the discussion about the timing and that there's no specific time by which these permits have to be issued, and the question of the fact that the issuance of permits does not fall under Section 1533. So C has been disregarded, and if I'm not mistaken, again, Conservation Force in its briefing does not challenge the district court's Judge Bates' decision on G1C. And indeed, he said...
What they say in their reply brief, though, is that the district court misapplied Bennett's discussion of C in addressing claims under A. That's their reply brief at 5.
What they're suggesting is that, I think the essence is that because there wasn't a robust discussion of G1A, that somehow Judge Bates applied or misapplied elements of A to C, but it's quite clear. If you read Judge Bates' decision, he tracks Bennett, he correctly applies Bennett, and finds that these issues as to the question of the permit processing claims are not reviewable under either G1A or G1C.
Well, you see where I have the greatest respect for Judge Bates. But the argument here is that page 5 of the reply brief, rather than separately addressing the Bennett Court's interpretation of A, the district court improperly incorporates the limitation on maladministration claims into its view of C. And if you look at Judge Bennett's decision, he's citing to the pages where the Supreme Court is discussing A.
Correct.
Yeah.
Well, I'll grant it's not.
I'm sorry. sorry, I got that wrong.
And I'm with you. Well, actually, the quote as to maladministration, Judge Bates says citizens may not sue for the secretary's maladministration of the ESA. That's the direct quote. That quote, if you look at Bennett, the secretary's maladministration of the ESA, that's directly from Bennett, and it's from the Bennett court's discussion of G1A.
It's where he says citizens may not sue for the secretary's maladministration of the ESA under this provision.
Right. The question is, okay, I see where you're going. I'll take you there. The question is, what is this provision?
I know, yeah.
There are three options. It can either be that Judge Bates is saying citizens may not sue for the secretary's maladministration under G1A, and that makes sense because it's directly from Bennett. Judge Bates, as I said, tracked Bennett, and that phrase is from the Bennett discussion about G1A. Well, let's say maybe Judge Bates, in saying this provision, was referring to G1C. Let's take away the label of G1C and look at what Judge Bates said.
In other words, you're arguing that the this provision has to refer to 1533.
No.
Well, because he doesn't cite A, he cites C.
He doesn't cite anything. Judge Bates doesn't cite anything in that sentence. He cites to Bennett only.
No, initially, just in the sentence before.
Well, yes, the discussion actually begins with both the APA and the ESA. And then, as I said in my opening remarks, Judge Bates then goes on to expressly discuss G1C. And we understand why he did that, because that's what Conservation Force was relying on in the district court. And actually, quite plainly, Conservation Force waived any G1A arguments in the district court. The fact that Judge Bates, this is so informal, but threw them a bone and included a sentence about G1A is really quite generous, because there is nothing in the district court pleadings about G1A, and indeed Conservation Force concedes that in their reply brief.
But just, our review is de novo, so Judge Bates could have said, I'm ruling this way because the moon is made of green cheese and it would not affect the outcome, except we actually have the benefit of a well-written opinion. Isn't that correct?
I think I follow you, and I think that's right. I'm sorry, do you mind restating it before I go ahead and agree with you?
Because our review is de novo, it doesn't make any difference.
Oh, on this legal
Judge
issue.
Bates said, right?
Right, right. But
deference to it doesn't matter.
So. Right, right. But quite simply, if we look at, though Judge Bates, for example, let's just say this. If Judge Bates had the sentence that said citizens may not sue for the secretary's maladministration at the ESA, and he put in parentheses G1A, we're all good, because that's what GA stands for according to Bennett. And then we can now say, well, Judge Bates did indeed expressly address G1A and is saying that these permit processing claims cannot be brought under G1A. The reason we're having this discussion is because Judge Bates said this provision and didn't provide us with an exact reference to what he was referring to. The bottom line I'm suggesting, and the government is suggesting, is it doesn't matter, because even if it is G1C, we still need to look at the sentence itself and what it means. What does it mean that claims cannot be brought to challenge the Secretary's administration of the statute? Then we take it to this case and say, was the Fish and Wildlife Service acting in the administration of the ESA? Was it carrying out the requirements and purposes and goals of the ESA? Was the Fish and Wildlife Service acting as the regulator? Well, indeed it was. It was making decisions. Folks were coming to the Fish and Wildlife Service for a permit, for permission, for a decision. And as the regulator, the Fish and Wildlife Service reviewed the applications and would issue a permit or issue a decision. Again, because it was acting as a regulator, everything it did in its capacity with respect to this permit processing system was in the administration of the ESA.
So even if the administrative record showed that there was a memorandum saying we have determined not to process any more permits, period, there still would not be a violation sufficient
If one wants to challenge that, you're saying, if there was such a memorandum and one wanted to challenge that, it's not a question of is it a violation. It is what in what capacity did the Fish and Wildlife Service issue that?
It's an APA violation, yes. Isn't it?
That's an APA, and that's because it is in the process of administering the statute. Indeed, that's absolutely correct.
Agency action unreasonably withheld.
Absolutely correct. Absolutely correct. So again, we need court needs to understand the categories in which this falls. When the Fish and Wildlife Service is acting as the administrator, we take it out of G1A because it's clearly an APA action.
Anything further?
I'm good.
Good.
Thank you.
Counsel for appellant.
Let me go straight to Bennett, if I may, unless you have a question. The Bennett was a suit against the Fish and Wildlife Service, and it was not the action agency. The action agency was the Bureau of Land Reclamation. You'll study the case, you'll see the Bureau of Land Reclamation is not named in the caption. There are two cases that we've cited that point that out, two Ninth Circuit cases. One is the they're attached. Environmental Protection Information Center, Ninth Circuit, 2001, and the other is the Salmon Spawning and Recovery Alliance et al., 2008. And this is what they said. The ESA citizen suit provision authorizes groups to bring suit against the State Department, in this case, as an action agency. That's crucial, the action agency. It makes all the difference. It distinguishes the suit in that case, in both of those cases, from the Bennett, because it was against an action agency, and one of those is the Fish and Wildlife Service, was the action agency. When an agency that is an acting agency is the one that's being sued, that's what 1540 G1A is all about. It's a regulation of the agency that's acting. In this case, we have the agency that acting is the Fish and Wildlife Service.
Forget about Bennett just for a second. Okay. I just go to the text of the statute under G1A. You have to show a violation of a provision and...
Or regulation,
uh-huh. Right. And that just brings me back to where I started in this case and what troubles me in trying to...
And we have
accept your position is I don't see a violation of any specific provision from delay.
Right. We have five or six provisions.
I read them all.
That and they together certainly provide what the courts have found is a general duty to recover species, not to jeopardize the species.
I'm with you on all that, but the precise question here is a timing requirement to act on a permit.
That brings us to the regulations of service.
I understand your bank shot argument, but there's no specific timing requirement.
Lifting from Bennett a statement, it is rudimentary administrative law that discretion as to the substance of the ultimate decision does not confer discretion to ignore the required procedures of decision-making. The required procedures of decision-making, in this case, the services required, are on the director. They are directed to the director, and there's three of them that we've found that have always governed the issuance of permits. And one of them says, 50 CFR 1311C, that the director will process all applications as quickly as possible, although that's not a certain time. As quickly as possible has a meaning, or if it has any meaning at all, it's not 9 years. The other one that we cite is 1722. Once again, it's directed to the director. And these are regulations adopted under 1533 of the ESA, a provision of the ESA to implement the act. The director will decide and shall issue permits. That violates the basic cardinal principle that how it's decided might be discretionary, but the fact that you've got to make the decision that you have to have procedures that you live by. It's fundamental due process. it's the core of all law in the world. They're ignoring the most fundamental business of process.
Well, that's why the APA is the catch-all Administrative Procedure Act requires agency action not to be unreasonably withheld. But that's
that will never get there because it never get to a judgment. And then this case proves it. 11 months, and it could have taken...
Well, that's the discrepancy between the attorney's fees provisions that apply to APA claims and apply to these claims is a policy question that Congress is aware of and the Supreme Court's aware of, but it's there.
Thank you for your courtesy.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We will take the case under advisement.